Hello and welcome back to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clemente, former New York City prosecutor, retired FBI profiler, and writer and producer on CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today is...
Laura Richards. I'm criminal behavioral analyst, former New Scotland Yard, and also the co-founder and director of Paladin, National Stalking Advocacy Service, and reviewer of domestic violence homicides, and author of the DASH, Risk Identification, Assessment, and Management Model.
And...
I am Lisa Zambetti. I am the casting director for Criminal Minds and Criminal Minds Beyond Borders, where I work with Jim Clemente.
So, welcome back, and we're very happy to be here. Today, though, we're going to be talking about a very serious case that has been in the news and will be back in the news shortly. It's the murder of Reeva Steenkamp, and this took place in South Africa. Reeva was a very beautiful, intelligent, and interesting person, and I'd like to have Laura tell us a little bit about her and her background.
Yeah, so Reeva was basically someone who wasn't just a pretty face. She was a model, but she also had a law degree, and she was one of the top 10 achievers in her law school at Nelson Mandela Metropolitan University. She was born in Cape Town on August the 19th, 1983, and then she moved to Johannesburg to pursue a modelling career. And after being a successful cover girl and television presenter, she appeared on numerous sort of reality shows. She was smart and funny and also successful, but she wanted to do much more to help survivors of abuse, and in particular spoke out numerous times against rape and did quite a lot of work to empower women. So it was somewhat of an irony that on February the 10th, 2013, she actually tweeted, "I woke up in a happy, safe home this morning. Not everyone did." And sadly and tragically, 4 days later, she's dead. And the whole world paid attention to what happened. And unfortunately, she got lost, I think, in the wash, which is what we see a lot of the time
with
victims.
Exactly.
They become a footnote in their own murder. And we've discussed that in other cases, like Nicole and Ron. And here we have it again.
Yes. And why did she become a footnote?
Well, because the offender is somebody who's far more, in inverted commas, interesting, popular, you know, celebrity status, Oscar Pistorius, who actually made everything about him. And again, we saw the whole trial and the media circus was so focused on him that they forget what he's actually on trial for, which is killing. And there's no dispute about that, killing this beautiful young woman who was in the prime of her life. And it all came down to, obviously, at the trial, was it premeditated or not? Was it an intentional act or not? So we're going to get into that, because there's a whole lot of information that Jim and I have, again, both having independently assessed and analysed the crime scene on its own, but also I was particularly interested in the context of their relationship, not just his relationship with Reeva, but what about the other girlfriends who could provide insight about how he behaved to them and who he was and how he viewed girls and women and significant women in his life, and also other people who had things to say, those from a position of knowledge from the inside, as it were, talking about the type of person that Oscar Pistorius was and the type of person that Reeva Steenkamp was.
Right, and if you've listened to our previous episodes of Real Crime Profile, you'll know that we like to give a voice to the victim. That actually, this is not the Oscar Pistorius case, this is the Reeva Steenkamp case. And she is the person whose life was taken. She is the person who was shot a number of times in the safety of the home where she was staying with Oscar Pistorius. He was a world-renowned sprinter. The first time somebody who had no legs below his knees. I think he had 9-inch stubs below his knees.
Fibulas, I believe.
And he basically was still able to, with his sort of rutting blades, compete in the Olympics, not the Paralympics, but the Olympics, against fully functioning people with full legs. He was that much of an athlete. And I think that in his case, we'll find out some interesting things about him and his behavior, but we'd like to do it through the eyes of Reva Steenkamp. Obviously, as Laura said, she was an accomplished young lady. She was sort of really kicking off her career. She'd been a model and went to law school. Really, her career was blowing up. And she was dating Oscar Pistorius for only about 4 months before she ended up being killed.
And that's quite an important thing to understand. So it's a short relationship. It's pretty intense as a relationship too. And we're going to go into the detail around messages that were sent back and forth, but just what other people were saying about that relationship, because that's really important, the intensity of things and also the whirlwind nature, which actually I pick up quite a lot when I'm reviewing domestic violence murders. And there was certainly intensity about this relationship, and there were certainly rules that he wanted her to abide to.
Yes.
I
mean, it's unbelievable when you see. We're going to look at her own words and his words to her in the form of the text messages that went back and forth. One of the first ones that they introduced in trial was him telling her to not say anything about an incident because his friend was going to take credit for it, because it's very important to him. He can't be seen as being involved in something like that. Now, it's unstated what that incident was, and it may have been the situation in which he fired a gun in a restaurant, and his friend took the blame for it so that he wouldn't get it, because it would ruin his image to the public, which was extremely important to him, and it would also possibly hurt his pocketbook.
His sponsorships.
Yes, yeah. His sponsorships might have gone away. So that's the first thing. And it doesn't, the only thing it really tells us about the relationship is that he asks her to say nothing about it. She actually thanks him. She wasn't gonna say anything about it, but she thanks him for letting her know. Okay, so thank you for telling me, and I won't say anything about it. What are you talking about, with the smiley face? In other words, she's like, wink, wink. I know what you're talking about, but I don't know what you're talking about. But then there's a series of text messages that actually reveal a tremendous amount about their relationship. And one of them starts out by saying, this is Reva texting to Oscar, there are a lot of things that can make us both feel like S**T. So there are a lot of things that can make us feel like shit. And we don't know, there was no written response to that, but apparently there's some indication there that something's off. There's a little bit of a problem here. And then she texts again, I'm just very honest. And she goes on to say, and another text says, I won't always think before I say something. Just appreciate that I'm not a liar. In other words, what she's saying apparently is in response to somebody suggesting that either she needs to think before she speaks or that she's lying about something. And she makes it a point to say that I'm not a liar, and I might not always think, but I'm giving you an honest opinion.
And just to clarify, these are WhatsApp messages. So for those who use WhatsApp, it's not like a text message where you're, you know, back and forth. Sometimes people will write a line and then they'll write something else immediately underneath it on a separate WhatsApp and then something else underneath it. So it's not necessarily waiting for a reply. It's just separate messages being sent in quick succession.
Right. And so Oscar writes back to Reva, I know it was just when you got back from Tropica, you made it sound like you'd only smoked weed once, and then last night that came out. I don't know how many times you took, or if you took other things, or, and this is the most important line here, I think, what you did when you were on them. So he's talking about her, apparently at some instance, revealing something about having taken drugs. And he had said that, well, before that, you told me you only smoked pot one time. But now I'm finding about these other things. And I want to know what's going on in my mind is what you did when you were on them. In other words, he is like this is the first indication of real control. Although he did tell her, don't talk about this other thing. That's a little bit of an indication of trying to control what she says and does. But this is real. What did you do when you were on them? Why is this important to him? So some time in the past, she took a drug, and now he's concerned what kind of behavior she exhibited while she was on those drugs. And I think as we go deeper, I think we'll see a little more what kind of behavior he's suggesting she might have done. So she writes back, I'm sorry if I upset you. It wasn't my intention. He writes back, I do appreciate it. In other words, he appreciates her apology. And then he said, could never be with someone that was. And then it stops. It doesn't say anything after that. And what was that word? That was a drug addict, that was something else.
I think what he's saying is, you know, that if it was her intention to upset him, then he couldn't be with someone who was that minded. So, and then she says, well, me neither, as in they're both acknowledging they're not in it to upset each other on, you know, a conscious level.
Right. And then, but later, when you skip down to two messages, it says, Reva says, I wasn't a stripper or a hoe. So I think that might be a reference back to that, mm-hmm. that he was suggesting that, and maybe he suggests by not saying the word, but, you know, what did you do when you were on drugs? Well, I wasn't a stripper or a hoe, okay? So I just think that she wouldn't have made those statements unless there was some suggestion of that. She also, there's also something in between where she says, it's like I see rabbit things in your house, and when you go places, you take pictures of them everywhere. For me, I'm thinking, who do you have that connection with? Because she obviously doesn't share this connection with rabbits. I'm thinking that he had a former girlfriend who was into rabbits. She gave him things. He had them hanging around his apartment, and he still likes taking pictures of them. And she's saying, well, I don't know who it is that you have that connection with. It's not with me.
I see.
But she says, and then she says, and the same things will play out in your mind. She, for me, I'm thinking, who do you have that connection with? And the same kinds of things play out in your mind. At the end of the day, this is now, not then. So don't worry about things that I did or who I was with in the past, and I won't worry about them with you. And again, she then follows up with, I wasn't a stripper or a hoe. So she's trying to set those ground rules. Like, don't go there with me. Don't tell me you think that's what I was doing. And she says, she goes on to say, I certainly have never been a prude, and I've had fun, but all innocent and without harmful repercussions. In other words, she was sexually active before. She wasn't a prude, but she was no hoe. She was not a prostitute or a stripper. And you know, she's a legitimate woman, and she will go on to say more about that later.
It kind of just angers me listening to this conversation, you know, as if with women there's only one, you know, two parts of the spectrum. You're either one thing, you're impure, you're a stripper, and you're, you know, all these negative words. And then on the other end, you know, you're a prude.
Mm-hmm.
And,
you know, Madonna whore.
Yeah, and it's just said in such a negative way each time. And this, for me, with Reva, isn't her setting boundaries. This is her on the back foot having to defend who she is. And at a very early stage, there's indications that he's accusing her of being things and doing things that are not within his rule set, that he doesn't see as being good behaviour, in inverted commas, for a girlfriend. So you're already seeing this kind of entitlement and rule setting and a double standard. And that's what she's hinting at. Whatever this rabbit thing is, she's saying there's a double standard here.
And she will go forward and be much more explicit about it in this. She sits down and writes a long message to him. And she says she's not 100% sure why she's even doing this, but she wants to get this out. So she said, today was one of my best friend's engagements, and I wanted to stay longer, and I was enjoying myself, but it's over now. So her wants, what she wanted to do, apparently was not followed. And she says, you have picked on me incessantly since you got back from Cape Town. Now, you have picked on me incessantly. So you're talking about a pattern of behavior. Not you picked on me once, but you've picked on me incessantly. It's been going on since you came back. I don't know what that time period was, but it's some time period, and that's important. I understand you're sick, but it's nasty. What you're doing to me is nasty. So basically, the fact that he came home sick means, in his mind, he's allowed to treat her badly, and that she's stating that's not good.
But it's a classic sympathy factor that we see, you know, in cases, that he's garnering the sympathy, and that can be transferred, you know, back for to justify why he's being and doing what he is. But saying picked on me incessantly is certainly a euphemism. You know, the undermining that would be there for her to actually say this and type this very long text message, WhatsApp message out, speaks volumes.
Yes. So yesterday wasn't nice for either of us, but we managed to pull through and communicate well enough to show our care for each other is greater than the drama that attacked us. And when she says that attacked us, drama that attacked us, it's very passive. It's not pointing the blame at him. It's saying some drama, some entity from outside came and attacked us. When in fact, I think the rest of this tells us it wasn't something from the outside.
That's because she's managing his behavior.
Yes.
So she's trying to manage him the whole time.
So that he doesn't blow up.
Yeah, exactly. Not to become inflammatory.
Right. And here's the clue, the major clue. I was not flirting with anybody today. I feel sick that you suggested that and that you made a scene at the table and made us leave early. I'm terribly disappointed in how the day ended and how you left me. We are living in a double standard relationship where you can be mad about how I deal with stuff when you are very quick to act cold and offish when you're unhappy. So there you have it. Double standard relationship. Exactly what you read out of the earlier text is what actually she states in very, very clear language, that he gets to set the rules, he gets to do what he wants, he gets to pick on her, but he's doing exactly the same things that he's complaining about with her. And this is an indication of control. She goes on to say, every 5 seconds I hear about you dated another chick. And I'm sure, although she doesn't have inverted commas around it, that's his word, not hers. And he probably says, oh, I went out with this one chick who did this, or that one chick that did that. She's hearing about it over and over and over again. But she follows up by saying, you really have dated a lot of people, yet you get upset if I mentioned one, all in caps, funny story with a long-term boyfriend. In other words, I've had a long-term boyfriend. I've lived in a relationship with that person. There's going to be things that come up. I mention one funny story about that, and one, and you go ballistic when you're always talking to me about people that you dated. Double standard. Mm-hmm. Control. This is a theme that we're going to see more and more and more of.
I also wonder if when she referenced strippers and hoes, that's not something that I feel like a woman would normally say. I mean, is that something she's hearing out of his mouth, just like chicks?
I really believe that he must have at the very least implied that, if not actually used those words with her. And here's another thing that I see direct parallels to the Nicole Brown case. I do everything to make you happy. And to not say anything to rock the boat. I mean, tell me that doesn't indicate that there's been a long history in these 4 months. There's been a long history of if I say or do anything, you blame it on me. So I'm trying to walk on eggshells so as not to rock the boat so we can live happily together. It sounds like this is an incredibly controlling person. He said, you do everything to throw tantrums in front of people. In other words, you'll see later when she talks about how he was so upset, and he will say in his own words that he was upset because she did things in front of other people, told him, change the song on the radio in front of other people. That really upset him. Yet he apparently has a history of getting upset in front of other people, throwing tantrums, and that's embarrassing her. I've been upset by you for 2 days now. So I'm so upset I left Darren's party early. So upset. Again, with the caps. So upset. I can't get that day back. And here's another line. Very important line. I'm scared of you sometimes. And how you snap at me. And how you react to me.
I mean, that's the most important part here. Everything else, you know, it's why we changed the law on coercive control, because of this sense when someone's being micromanaged or someone's using their moods or other people around them to control the other person's reaction. But the fact that she says that she's scared, you know, in a healthy relationship, one is not scared by the other. So, you know, when people say, well, he never hit her, he doesn't need to, at the point where actually all these things that he's doing is actually getting the result he desires, which is to control her behaviour. But healthy relationships, one is not scared by the other. And, you know, here we have clear indications, and she does caveat it by saying sometimes. And, you know, she says that he does make her happy 90% of the time. Mm-hmm. Well, we know that abusers aren't abusive all of the time. And, you know, that's another important part of understanding this very short, intense relationship that they've had, where it's magnified beyond, you know, the reality of what it is. This is two people still trying to understand who each other are,
right,
and how they fit together.
Right, they're still in the honeymoon period. 4 months is nothing.
And this should be the good stuff. This should be the great time where everything's going well.
Was the good stuff.
Yeah.
But clearly it's not.
And no, I know, but what I'm saying, this is the best it was.
These are the clear indications, you know, when we talk about or talk with victims or clients where they're not sure whether they're being abused, the context is, in this first 6 to 8 months to a year, it is the honeymoon. This is where everything is good. So if you're having these kind of problems around intensity and one controlling the other at this very early stage, these are clear warning signs that things are not good. This is a union that's going to be, some might describe it as volatile, in inverted commas. That's a euphemism for abuse. But this is somebody who's used to getting his way, and when he behaves like this, he normally gets what he wants.
Right.
So she's trying to manage him. She doesn't want the conflict. She doesn't want that in her life. She just wants to work things through with him.
Right, she wants the 90% good stuff. And she says, you make me happy 90% of the time, and I think we are amazing together. And here we go again. But I am not some other bitch you may know trying to kill your vibe. And I think, again, could put inverted commas around that. I think this is his word, not hers. I think he has said, you're just like some the other bitches that I went out with who killed my vibe. You know, and she wanted to put that out there. I am not that person. I am not that kind of person, and you shouldn't be treating me like this.
You see, the thing is here, Jim C., and I've seen it when, you know, and heard it when I've listened sadly to messages just like this. Sometimes I've listened to voicemails at the point of a murder trial, is that I genuinely believe, and I can't hear her tone in this, but I believe there isn't a tone to it, you know, that she's saying this in a, although it's a text message, she's not saying it in an aggressive way to lay down the law. She's trying to give her his point, sorry, she's trying to give him her point of view and trying to fix it so that he understands where she comes from. But I don't think there's a tone here. You know, I think it's just laying it out. And why I say that, there's one particular case that I worked on where there was no malice from the victim whatsoever, even though he would call her, he would start with, you know, all the putting her on a pedestal and complimenting her. And by the end of the call, when she doesn't do what he wants, he then starts to become angry and he threatens her. But at no point was there any malice on her side. She's just saying, you know, I will never come back to you. This is the situation. And I believe, you know, at the start of this relationship, she's level-headed and she's just trying to, she hasn't experienced this kind of situation before. She's just trying to manage him.
Right.
And make clear her point of view.
Well, that's a good point. And yeah, I did read some attitude into it. But I still think that the words bitch and killing your vibe,
yeah,
I think those are his
words. She's parroting it back to him.
And this is what we hear with victims of abuse, that we always hear the voices of the abuser. I mean, for years on, you hear the perpetrator's voice. And that's why some clinical psychologists have to do work with the victims to try and wake them up, because they're in this kind of sleep mode of everything. They don't know what they like to eat. They don't know what they want to do at different times of the day because they're so used to being controlled. And this is the slow brainwashing process that's starting to seep in. She's using his words, but trying to communicate with him on his level, because they're the things that he says about girls and women.
I'm listening to these and I don't understand. Here's this beautiful woman. She's smart. She knows all about domestic violence issues and rape and all kinds of violence against women. I mean, she is involved in, you know, advocating for women. How does she not say, fuck off? I mean, how does she not go, forget this? I could get any guy. You know, she walks into a room.
Called intensity and chemistry. And, you know, when you
charisma.
Experience that, it's very powerful. You know, she and he are clearly You know, if I use the word infatuation, that's one of my least favourite words, because actually the other side to it is obsession. And but I do think in this situation, you've got this infatuation between two people and an intensity that when you feel that chemistry and you have someone, you know, she is very charismatic, but in a non-abusive way, and he is very charismatic and manipulative, but in a way that is entitled, that he wants to get what he wants, and therefore all the rules are his rules. And she is just trying to work out this relationship at these early stages. You know, is this something that's going to work? So she's managing him.
Yeah.
And actually, the insidious nature of it, majority of people don't get when they're in it. You know, that they may feel that they're trying to manage the situation, and maybe it's just they don't get each other's point of view in the early stages. So she's trying to give him an alternative point of view and get him to understand her. You know, and you do have to work out whether you fit together, and that does take time. Yeah. But it's which point do you press the buzzer and actually say, no, I'm out of this? You know, do you do it so early on, which some people, particularly when they've experienced abuse, you know, will do it very quickly thereafter, and other people might not. They may continue to get that, you know, that heady feeling when they're with someone, the person who, you know, is a mover and a shaker and exciting and fun to be with. And by all means, he was someone who was exciting and fun to be with.
Yeah. Well, I just want to insert this real quick because I know American audiences don't know Oscar Pistorius as well as they know O.J. Simpson. So when we talked about O.J.'s charisma, a lot of us probably knew what that meant. I mean, as far as Oscar goes, I mean, he was just this symbol of inspiration, and he was on Time Magazine's list of 100 most influential people, and a lot of people looked up to him because of him overcoming, you know, serious disabilities in order to become a champion. So, I mean, I'm sure that takes a lot to be able to do that.
Yeah, his psychology and his psychopathology was, you know, that he basically achieved extraordinary things against all odds.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, being born without... well, actually, he was born without fibula, which meant that both of his legs were amputated below the knee. And, you know, it was assumed that he probably wouldn't be able to do anything in his life. But his mother basically had a sort of a rule that your brother puts on his shoes and now you put your legs on.
Mm-hmm.
And any time that he heard no or that he was disabled, he turned that into a positive and a yes. And, you know, he did extraordinary things, not just in the Paralympics, but also in the Olympics. And he's the first person, he was nicknamed the Blade Runner. So this is absolutely somebody who would turn a no into a yes, repeatedly through his life, achieved extraordinary things and would never take no for an answer. You know,
and
so
he's incredibly handsome. I mean, looking at pictures of him,
he's handsome,
right now,
he's athletic, he's accomplished, he's driven, and all those things are attractive to Riva, and they should be.
Yes.
So it's, we can't blame her for being in this. She just didn't see it. She has a good mind. She has a good heart. She has a good soul. She does not see ugly in other people. She's looking for the good in other people. And clearly, the fact that she sat down and went through all this with him means that she really had hope that it could all work out. 90% of the time, it's just the 10% that's bad.
But he was a huge celebrity, you know, in South Africa, and he was nicknamed Blade Runner. But, you know, he turned into not just being the athlete, but was a well-known, you know, the person that took the nose to a yes, was having, you know, huge endorsements from Nike, Oakley, you know, got the tables in the restaurants and was treated with a celebrity lifestyle. And for her, you know, upcoming and, yeah, she's, you know, busting some things in terms of, you know, getting out on the circuit. And, of course, she's super smart as well, that this chance union between them is incredibly exciting, I think, for both of them. You know, he was equally smitten with her. So, you know, you have to put it back in its context that sometimes you get a spark between two people, and that chemistry, you know, you can bottle it. It doesn't necessarily mean, you know, and sell it for a lot of money, but it doesn't necessarily mean to say that it's a healthy spark. And when you have that chemistry, and particularly the sexual chemistry, it's not always
so overpowering.
And people act in different ways, you know. But I think Riva, from listening to her parents, you know, was somebody who came from a very strong and close family. They hadn't experienced, you know, abuse. And so this was something that she was just trying to manage and work out whether it's something she could stay in. And even in her message, the very long message, you know, you can see that her mind's already thinking about maybe this isn't going to work out.
In fact, that's where she goes. She says, I am the girl who let go with you, even when I was scared out of my mind to. Now, that's debatable whether she means physically scared
or just scared to let go. So there's, I'm not willing to say that it was definitely that she was saying that she was scared out of her mind of him, but I think people did try to interpret it that way.
I mean, I read it that actually it was more about, you know, the headiness of the relationship that she's quite feeling a bit cautious about, because it's pretty overpowering. I mean, the fact he is this celebrity, and, you know, I can imagine that any female being caught up in that, you know, you have to think carefully. If you're someone like Reva, she's smart, she's got her own thing going on. You know, am I going to just be taken along and be, you know, on his arm? Or actually, is this something I want to get involved with? I'll be more under the spotlight, you know, or I have to think carefully about this.
Yeah, and not only, you know, I think it's something that he actually uses as well. You know, the fact that he doesn't have regular legs and that he, you know, he's sort of the sympathy card. He probably plays both sides of this, that I'm such a tough guy and I'm an accomplished thing, athlete and, you know, Olympic athlete and a celebrity, but at the same time, I'm also, you know, this poor guy who doesn't have all of his, you know, physical body together. So I think he may have played on that. But she said, I'm the girl who fell in love with you and wanted to tell you this weekend, but I'm also the girl that gets sidestepped when you're in a shit mood. When I feel...
Well, actually, Jim, that tells us something right there. You know, I'm the girl who fell in love with you. That tells you about intensity. You know, it depends where you come from as to whether you think you can fall in love with someone, you know, within such a short space of time. Some people think there's love at first sight, etc. But do you know each other after 4 months?
Clearly not in this case.
So that tells us about the intensity and just the whirlwind of her being, you know, probably fearfully being carried along down this track.
Yeah, and then she follows it with, but you sidestep me when you're in a bad mood. In other words, I wanted to tell you I loved you this weekend, but look what happened. Look what you did. Look how you destroyed it. It could have been great. And this is something that apparently is a pattern in their relationship. So she says, when I feel you think you have me, so why try anymore? So this they did have apparently a short honeymoon period, and she's now feeling like he thinks, well, she loves me. I've got her locked in. I don't have to do anything. I don't have to do anything to treat her well. I don't have to do anything for her anymore.
Classic power and control. And, you know, once I've got you under my control, then I behave in a different way. So she's already clocking that that's what's going on, this kind of odd shift each time that she kind of relents to his, you know, and gets drawn into the relationship and to him, then he starts behaving really badly.
Right.
So she's already noting that and talking about, you know, that she gets snapped at. I get snapped at and told my accents and my voices are annoying.
I mean, really? It's unbelievable. And it's going to get worse. I touch your neck to show you I care, and you tell me to stop. Stop chewing gum. Do this. Don't do that. I mean, these are classic power and control lines. These are classic things that these guys do to corral their victims into a particular way of acting, of being, so that they can, like, literally control their entire life.
You see, this is more than domestic abuse. This is coercive control. And we do differentiate it because it's much more about the erosion of someone's sense of self. So just undermining, you know, her accent, her voice, every little nuanced detail about who she is, the things that he said that he's fallen in love with are now the things that he's trying to, you know, pull apart, telling her not to chew gum, you know, constantly kind of getting under her skin and making her second guess herself and keeping her off balance. This is really destructive and concerning behavior on his part.
And it keeps her apologizing. It kind of keeps her
on the edge constantly. You know, she's now got to appease him and whatever his rules are. And this is the problem with coercive control. You don't know what the rules are. And, you know, the person who makes the rules up keeps changing them. And, you know, if you fluff the left cushion, it should have been the right cushion. So you're never going to win in this kind of situation. And she's already putting her finger exactly on these are all the problems that are going on and how it's undermining her and making her feel absolutely terrible about herself.
So she's actually very insightful about what's going on, but she has the hope that this is just an anomaly. This is not who you are. This is just an anomaly. She says, you don't want to hear stuff. Cut me off. Your endorsements, your reputation, your impression of someone innocent, blown out of proportion, and fucked up a special day for me.
So it seems to me that she's talking about the fact that he says to her, you know, you're going to ruin my endorsements, you know, with your behavior. You know, if you're a drug addict, if you're a whore, if you're a stripper, you know, these kinds of things he must have thrown at her before. That his impression, that his reputation is incredibly important, but your impression of someone innocent blown out of proportion. So, well, like, I thought you were an innocent, you know, pure woman that I could date, but now I'm finding out you're this maniac who's hitting on people and doing all this drugs, and maybe you're a stripper and a whore. But she says, and this is another thing that we saw in Nicole's case, I'm sorry, if you truly felt I was hitting on my friend Sam's husband, and I'm sorry that you think that little of me. I mean, there is a powerful statement. In other words, she's saying, I'm going to do what I have to do to manage his behavior, which is, I'm sorry if you thought I was doing that, hitting on my friend's husband. But I'm also sorry that you think that little of me. In other words, it's biting. I mean, she's getting back at him in a very subtle way here, saying that it's sad that you think that little of me, that I could be doing that, that I'm not just being social, that I'm not just being friendly to my friend's husband. But, you know, he takes it to another level.
And I think she's trying to constructively maneuver through these problems, but she's also, I think sort of laying the marker down that he probably puts her on a pedestal as well, conversely. And I'm sure when they probably got together, you know, from analysing so many cases as I have, he probably put her on a pedestal. So what she's trying to do is reconcile these two images that he's portraying of her. One, you know, where he's complimentary and when he's trying to get together with her in the first place. And then the other now, which is taking her down off the pedestal and basically saying, you know, you're cheating on me, you're hitting on, you know, her friend's husband. And she's kind of putting it in the context that, you know, that's not who she is. Mm. But I think she's probably trying to reconcile these two things that he has, images that he's created of her, the pedestal, you know, this kind of angel demon scenario, which we see in a lot of, sadly, you know, coercively controlling situations, and dangerous and risky situations. I mean, she goes on to say, from the outside, I think it looks like we are a struggle, and maybe that's what we are. I just want to love and be loved, be happy and make someone so happy, in capitals. Maybe we can't do that for each other, because right now I know you aren't happy, and I certainly am very unhappy and sad.
Okay.
That's the part, you know, where I think she's very rational in what she's saying, and she clearly sees it for what it is. You know, I don't think she's naive. I don't think this is somebody who doesn't understand what's going on here. I think she absolutely does. But she's trying to see whether there's a way around it. You know, and people do that. They try and see whether they can work it out, whether she can give him a different point of view, her perspective. And if he does say and mean all the things he said originally when they got together, maybe she can rationalize and he can, you know, they can see reason and they can see a pathway through in this relationship. And it gets a response immediately because he sends back a message. Well, we don't know the time frame, actually, so I shouldn't say that. But he does say, please let me know when I can call you.
Right. And she writes back, I'm here. I mean, here, just to put this in context, because this ultimately ends in her death, her homicide. And he wants the world to believe that that was an isolated incident born out of fear that somebody might have broken into the house, when everything that we've talked about is a very compressed pattern of behavior that is very similar to what happened in O.J. Simpson, Nicole Simpson case, that it was a pattern of abusive and controlling behavior that ended ultimately in the death of the person that was trying to be controlled, that the offender was trying to control. And I think it's just, if you look at it in isolation, if you look at it without this context,
you're looking at this accomplished sprinter who's made, you know, he was disabled, but he's not disabled. He's actually enabled, and he's out there winning medals and making, you know, everybody in his country proud and all that. And the world was cheering for this
guy. Absolutely.
In fact, his phrase was, "You're not disabled by the disabilities you have. You are able by the abilities you have."
There you go. And people loved him for that. I mean, it was a great line. But in fact, we have to look deeper than that surface. And so when he writes back to Reva, he says, I want to talk to you. I want to sort this out. I, right?
Narcissistic.
Yes, very. I don't want to have anything less than amazing for you and I. I am sorry for the things I say without thinking. So it's, I said those things because I wasn't thinking, not because I'm a bad person, and for taking offense to some of your actions. Really. The fact that I'm tired and sick isn't an excuse, although
right,
you used it as an excuse, yes. I was upset that you just left me after we got food to go talk to a guy.
Not, this sounds like high school all of a sudden. It's like so juvenile.
But to talk to a guy, not your friend's husband, right? And this is the most insidious line here in this whole answer. I was standing right behind you, watching you, okay? I was standing right behind you, watching you touch his arm and ignore me. He has
there
to
I
be
am.
The center. Yeah, like, what? I'm here behind you. Maybe she didn't even know you were there.
And you're not paying me the attention that
yes.
I deserve. You know, he's injured and insulted. Mm. His ego is, his narcissism is, because he expects her immediately to turn on to the fact that he's there.
Right. And he says, and when I spoke up, you introduced me, which you could have done. In other words, you could have done that before. Like, why did you have to wait till I spoke up? But when I left you, no, when I left, you just kept on chatting with him. When I clearly was upset.
So this is rejection as he sees it.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's like, look, I gave you the indications that I was upset. You should have walked away from that guy because you were talking to him and not me. Meanwhile, she's at an event. These are her friends. He's out there, you know, signing autographs, talking to fans and all that stuff. She just is talking to a friend of hers. I mean, it's just outrageous. And then he goes, I asked Martin to put on that Kendrick Lamar album in the car and don't know it. I think he meant he didn't know what the songs were. He said, granted, that was a shit song, but you should have just leant forward and whispered in my ear to change it. In other words, how dare you say it out loud when my friend was in the car with us? How dare you do that?
Wait, what did she do? She asked to change this?
Yeah. Can you change this song? It's a shit song.
And so he's basically saying he wants to modify her behavior by saying, this is actually what you should have done, therefore this is what you got wrong. So these
yes.
are the rules that
yes.
are unwritten, unspoken about, that she's meant to have some kind of telepathy, that this is the way she's meant to act.
I asked him to put on that song. I asked him. So you don't embarrass me in front of my friends by saying the song is no good. Whisper, lean over and whisper so he can't tell that you're telling me you don't like the song I picked.
And insulting me and upsetting my ego. But this is the kind of thing that you would expect to see, because it talks about, you know, aggressive narcissism, that everything revolves around him,
mm-hmm.
and she has to conform. She's just a bit part to conform to his wants, his will, and not embarrassing or upsetting
him.
He
just sounds like a pouty baby to me.
But,
I mean, it's ridiculous.
He's not. He's a powerful man, by the way. But here's the thing. He then goes on to say, look, you know, we were late and I had to go pick up your friend. Why didn't you just tell your friend to drive herself? That caused all these problems. And then I was hungry and you didn't. I mean, it was all this stuff, this crap, you know.
All I had was a tiny wrap for lunch and everyone was leaving for lunch and I was starving. I wanted to go, but I was hungry and upset. And although you knew it, it wasn't like you came to chat to me when I left the table. So it's all me,
this
myself, and I.
This is all in a text.
Me, myself,
yes,
and I.
This is all in a text. So he's saying, I left the table and you didn't come follow me. I was upset when I left you because I thought you were coming to me. In other words, not like, hey, babe, can we go talk? Or can we talk for a minute? It's like, I'm upset, I'm leaving, and I just expect you're going to follow me. leave your friends at an event that you came to, that you want to talk to these people, you're having a good time. No, I want to leave. That's it. What you want doesn't matter anymore, because now, I'm sorry I asked you to stop tapping my neck yesterday. I know you were just trying to show me love. I had a mad headache. Excuses. Mm-hmm. And should have just spoken to you softly. So you know then that the way he spoke to her was not softly,
right,
or lovingly. Mm-hmm. He must have really been rude. I'm sorry for asking you not to put on an accent last night. Pretty much the same. He's saying pretty much the same reason. I had a mad headache and didn't have the energy. Like, to put up with her using an accent?
What accent is he talking about? Well, don't they both have accents? Don't they both?
Well, to them.
Maybe she was putting on a funny accent. But, I mean, my read of it is literally everything she did, said, and everything, every behavior was not...
Yeah, but he's telling her how to speak. Mm-hmm. Like, maybe, I mean, in South Africa, I'm sure there are very...
different dialects, yeah.
Yeah, but there are very, you know, professional
posh
accents, and there are probably things that are more guttery, mm-hmm, and, you know, maybe she was doing something that embarrassed him. But
he may have just been fooling around, and, you know, she did a funny kind of, mm-hmm, you know, accent, and it just irritated him. That's the impression I get. Just everything she did irritated him.
Right. So then, this is actually about a week later, a little more than a week later, she writes to him. Revo writes to him, I like to believe that I made you proud when I attend these kind of functions with you. I present myself well and can converse with others while you are off busy chatting to fans and friends. The fact that she feels, and in this relationship, she has to prove to him that she looks good and she can speak to people intelligently and let him go off and do the things he had to do. I mean, it's sad.
She's justifying herself, and this is exactly the under-the-skin stuff that leaves you not knowing which way is up. You know, mm-hmm, she thinks that she's doing all the right things. She's supportive of him. He can go off and do all the things he needs to do, and she's fitting in and not, you know, making a scene or a stir and talking to people, and that they can function independently.
Now, remember, this is a separate event, okay? So the first one was an engagement event that they were at, her friends. This one is an event that he invited her to, but she's like, I went there to make you look good. You know, I'm not some stripper or hoe. I'm actually an intelligent, good-looking, you know, conversant person who can talk to people and so forth. So she goes on to say, I also knew people there tonight, and whilst you were having one or two pictures taken, I was saying goodbye to the people in my industry, and Fitz wanted a photo with me. So apparently he bought up the fact that she was talking to yet another guy. I was just being cordial and saying goodbye whilst you were busy. I completely understand your desperation to leave and thought I would be helping you by getting to the exit before you because I can't rush on the heels I was wearing. So in other words, she apparently walked ahead of him and not with him to go to the door. I thought it would make a difference in us getting out without you getting harassed anymore. I didn't think you would criticize me for doing that, especially not so loudly so that others could hear. So he criticized her very loudly in a crowd, in a public setting. She's a professional woman. This is very embarrassing to her. And yet he did all this stuff.
I think it's not just embarrassing. I think it's insulting. I think, you know, she feels really under threat and attack, and she just can't do anything right. And, you know, being attacked in front by of friends or fans or whoever, but it's not just embarrassing and humiliating. It's also, you know, this is a person who's meant to love and care for you and meant to be looking out for you, and it completely undermines everything you are about, but also where's this relationship going? Where's it heading?
Right. And I think you're right when you said earlier, because her next line is, I might joke around and be all tomboyish at times, but I regard myself as a lady, and I didn't feel like one tonight after the way you treated me when we left. I'm a person too. Oh my God. And I appreciate that you invited me out tonight, and I realize that you get harassed, but I'm trying my best to make you happy, and I feel as though you sometimes never are, no matter the effort I put in.
And that's a lot. She said a tremendous amount there. I didn't feel like a lady tonight, the way you treated me.
Well, it's very telling. And the fact, you know, he's using now the excuse that he gets harassed and, you know, by fans, etc. There's always an excuse and a reason to justify why he's keeping her off balance and why he's undermining her in every way. And again, you know, most of the cases I work, the abuser, the perpetrator has a reason every time. It's just because my headache, I was hungry, I didn't have this, I was being... You need to understand it from my point of view. And
right.
They turn the table every time.
Right, and what do we know about psychopaths? They don't have human empathy, right? They can mimic it, right? They have a shallow veneer of they have this charisma, they draw people in and all that stuff. They're thrill seekers. Sometimes they're, you know, they really
they're
have exciting lives, right?
But high levels of manipulation and aggressive narcissism only seen from one point of view,
right.
And that's me, myself, and I.
And what does she say? I'm a person too. Well, we know that psychopaths don't look at people as people. They look at people as things that they can use, things that are convenient for them, things that are complementing their lives, and that's it. And it seems like in that one line, she is basically calling him out as somebody who doesn't see her as a person.
And she's saying, here I am. You know, I'm also, where am I in this relationship? Mm. Because the balance is just tipped, that there's only one person that seems to matter continuously and consistently. And I can imagine going to these do's, you know, you have to psychologically build yourself up too. She's walking into these things and she's trying to present a united front and trying to make him happy in every way. And just every... thing that she does, every time, you know, she says something or does something, he attacks and criticizes and just undermines her sense of self, that she's at this stage wondering, you know, how does she ever make him happy? Does she actually add anything to this relationship? And I think her last line is just, you know, even more telling and, you know, really does provide insight on this relationship, where she says, I can't be attacked by outsiders for dating you and be attacked by you, the one person I deserve protection from.
It's incredibly insightful and haunting.
It's chilling.
It is chilling.
Absolutely chilling.
Because that is the exact defense that he will use in defending himself when he murdered her. He claims that the reason why he shot into the bathroom was because he was afraid for his life and he was trying to protect Reva, who he thought was still in the bed. But in the next episode, we will cover the facts and circumstances, we'll reconstruct the crime scene, and we'll talk about what actually went down in that bedroom suite that night, because it certainly was not what Oscar Pistorius says it was.
We didn't talk about how she was killed yet, but we will.
We will. We'll get to that. I mean, there were so many inconsistencies in his account in particular, and the crime scene assessment and analysis just does not make sense in terms of what he says went down. So we'll go into the detail of that.
Yes.
Just one question. You just read something about, I can't be attacked by outsiders for dating you.
Yes.
What does that mean?
In other words, that other people are saying to her, like, why are you dating this guy? I mean, he treats you like an ass. He doesn't respect you. I mean, I'm sure, can you imagine 10 days earlier, she's at an event with her friends, and he acts up and treats her badly, and then again this day?
Right.
So she's saying that people...
So they see it.
They see it and they comment to her about it.
Somewhere in her ear saying that.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And how long after, do you know the time period for this text that you just read? Until she was killed, do you guys have a sense of...
So the last message, I mean, the last
it's
one
February
that
came 8th.
Out was February 8th, and she was killed on February the 14th.
On Valentine's Day.
A week.
On Valentine's Day, which again, you know, we'll talk about that context, because there's something, you know, crazy that goes on Valentine's Day too.
Yes! I was sorry about that, but go ahead. Yes, go ahead, sorry.
Is it the same thing that we're about to say?
I don't know.
You know, in terms of just the intensity that day brings of what it means to people. And actually it does create this kind of intense vacuum of how people should behave and, you know, what they should share and gestures, etc. So I think the day is also an important day in the sense it's, you know, an anniversary of their relationship and she's going to say that she loves him for the first time. So I think in a very short relationship, this contextual stuff is really important as to what then unfolds that day and that night.
So real quick before we go, so Valentine's Day, I'm in New York City living in a big apartment building, and I hear this music, that Whitney Houston song, I Will Always Love You, that song
and
is blaring for hours. And I'm like, who the fuck, what is going on? And I look out my window and all of a sudden I see stuff start falling out the window. Clothes, books, lamps, everything was coming out of this on a high rise. And I'm like, what's going on? And I go, a friend of mine in the building, we go up to the top floor. This guy had gone crazy. It was Valentine's Day. His wife, it was like an anniversary of his divorce. And he went insane and threw all of his belongings out the window.
Did he kill anybody? No,
thank goodness he didn't. But yeah, Valentine's Day is like...
It's a stressor for many people in many relationships. And in this case, it ended up...
lethal consequences. Yes.
God. Anyway. Okay, well, more about that next time, you guys.
Our next episode.
Thank you.
Of Real Crime Profile. Next time, we'll also cover... in an episode shortly, we'll cover listener questions. Thanks for writing to us, mm-hmm. and thank you for your support and for your questions, because they're great, and comments. And if you do have any issues that we can address, and hopefully you're safe in your lives, but if there's any issues that we can help you with, we hope we will be able to do that.
I want to shout out to one of our listeners, Halls. She's been very worried, Laura, that you weren't going to bring me back chocolate hobnobs.
Oh, my goodness. I almost got the hobnobs.
And I've got them, Halls.
Chocolate hobnobs,
yay!
Are safe and sound. They made their way to L.A. Okay. All is good in the world, or Lisa's world, anyway.
That's right. Well, we love you guys. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you. Talk to you soon.
So if you're a fan of the show and you want to help us out, there's a few things you can do. First, subscribe to the show on iTunes, talk to your friends about us, and share the links. And it'd also be great if you could take a survey from our new network, Wondery, at wondery.com/survey.
For advice or support, if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0207 840 8960 or go on the website www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic violence, call the National Domestic Violence Helpline free phone 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter, safety or counselling, call the Genesis 24-hour hotline 214-946-4357 or go on the website www.genesisshelter.org, or you can call the National Domestic Violence Hotline on 800-799-7233.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan, engineered by Jacob Moose Molin. Music is composed and performed by Simba Sumba. Logo art by Rob Cohen. Real Crime Profile is produced and recorded at Empire Studios LA by XG Productions. Real Crime Profile is distributed by Wondery.